Today, for perhaps the last time, what Janet Yellen is actually thinking. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. 12th of July, today, Wednesday. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. The relevant macroeconomic policy statute on this Wednesday is colloquially known as the Humphrey-Hawkins Act of 1978, in which were codified two principal things. Number one, the Federal Reserve's dual mandate, that is, A, steady inflation, also known as price stability, and B, full employment. Item number two, that twice a year the Fed chair would schlep up to Capitol Hill and tell Congress what in the world is going on with the economy. Today, as you might have gathered from that brief preamble, is a Humphrey Hawkins testimony day. So here with a couple of highlights from Chair Janet Yellen's testimony. First of all, and this is something that gets highlighted every month when the unemployment report comes out, what is up with this economy adding jobs, Dr. Yellen, but wages staying stuck?
Well, we are seeing attenuated links, I think, between the labor market and wages, but even to a greater extent, prices and inflation. The relationship between those two things has become more attenuated than we've been accustomed to historically.
Okay, about inflation, also on congressional minds today, interest rate hikes, when and how they might happen.
We'll recognize inflation has been running under our 2% objective, that there could be more going on there. It's something that we will watch very carefully and will be a factor in our future decisions about rate increases.
Or, as she likes to say, we'll see what the data says. Got to give a nod here to the parlor game that has started unfolding in political Washington over whether President Trump will reappoint Chair Yellen when her term as chair is up in January. Here's the answer to that one.
I absolutely intend to serve out my term. I'm very focused on trying to achieve our congressionally mandated objectives, and I really haven't had to give further thought at this point to this question.
If she's not reappointed, by the way, this week is her last scheduled testimony on Capitol Hill. One of the things the Fed does in this economy is to help manage the money supply, which gets us to this. Visa, the credit card company, really, really wants small businesses in this economy to go cashless. The company announced a promotion today that'll give 50 restaurants, cafes, and food trucks $10,000 American dollars as long as they swear off using actual currency. There are out there already a number of businesses that have stepped away from cash. Marketplace's Adrian Hill takes a look at why.
The salad chain Sweetgreen has gone cashless at most of its restaurants, including this one in Midtown New York. Isabel Bingham, waiting in line for a salad, has never actually noticed.
Couchless? Oh, cashless. Oh, I did not know that.
There are a lot of good reasons for legit tax-paying businesses to go cashless. Cash takes time and attention. It costs to count it, move it, guard it.
Stopping cash pilferage by your employees is actually tricky business.
Kenneth Rogoff is an economics professor at Harvard University.
It also raises your insurance. If you're carrying lots of cash in your till, you're more likely to get robbed, and your insurance is going to be higher.
There are hygiene issues having cash near food. I mean, those dollar bills are covered with bacteria. But there are also reasons to think a lot of small businesses won't jump to cashless anytime soon. Some have customers without access to banks. The FDIC estimates that's still 7% of U.S. households. And some businesses have an older set of customers. Those businesses will also keep accepting cash.
I think there is the whole notion of generationality around cash.
Ravi Shankar Chaturvedi is from the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He says if you look at the world from the eyes of an entering college freshman,
cash is something that she probably associates with her grandparents.
Which might help explain that couchless misunderstanding. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
In corporate news today, Walmart is tightening the screws on its supply chain. Bloomberg reports today the company's new rules are called on time in full. The translation for the company's vendors goes like this. Deliver your product a day late, you pay a fine. You deliver your product a day early, you also pay a fine. Walmart says that could add as much as $1 billion in revenue with supply chain efficiencies. But as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, That really is just fancy talk for what we already know. This is an on-demand world, and we just live in it.
Walmart has a reputation for being a ruthless cost cutter, for wringing every last dime out of prices their suppliers charge. Well, okay, yeah, that's true enough, but that isn't what's really driving this latest move.
Walmart is really responding to what we all want.
Dan Sanker is the CEO of CaseStack, a logistics solutions company. He says the way people shop now is so different than it used to be, retail stores need to change too.
We want everything available to us wherever we are. We want really low prices. We want to be able to have it delivered. We want to be able to pick it up. You know, we have pretty high expectations.
In order to meet those expectations, Walmart's trying to remove the variability from its supply chain, something that could also benefit suppliers.
It doesn't do suppliers any good to have their dollars tied up in inventory that isn't moving through the system.
Shannon Bedore runs Sightline Retail, an advisor for suppliers of big box stores. She says Target has a similar policy, and if retailers want to compete with Amazon, soon everyone will be doing it.
You can't just fill a warehouse and you can't just fill a store with product. It has to be really productive inventory for everybody who is working in brick and mortar.
The 3% cost of goods fine for products that don't arrive on time or aren't packaged properly could make Walmart more expensive to work with. But given the opportunity the company represents, Bedore says suppliers will quickly figure it out. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, record high on the Dow, noting, however, for the record, that markets go down, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow's the day version 2.0 of the Senate's health care bill is going to be made public. The contents will be closely scrutinized in policymaking circles and in business circles as well, smaller businesses in particular, where providing health care benefits can be a real expense. Kerry Quigley runs the Sterling Technologies plant out in Lake City, Pennsylvania, near Erie. They make plastic containers, everything from rain barrels to dog crates. We met him when we were out there around Inauguration Day, and we got him back on the phone today to talk about healthcare and the rest of the economy he's doing business in. Kerry, it's good to talk to you again.
Great to speak with you, Kai.
First of all, how's business? How's life at Sterling?
Business is okay. We're still growing. We're still working and still good. Still running 24/7.
Wow. All right. Well, you can't get much more busy than that, I guess. When we were out there in January, one of the things you and I talked about was, as a straight business issue for you guys, was healthcare, Obamacare, and how much you were looking forward to repeal. So with that as background, how you feeling about all the back and forth in Washington on healthcare reform?
Yeah, you know, great question. Still seems to be a lot of smoke in the air, but some of the things that are starting to clear up for us. And it looks like things like the individual mandate, employer mandate are really going to make a huge difference, particularly to our workforce who is relatively young. So we're pretty excited about some of the reform that we think we're going to see come out of this.
Let me make sure I get that right. You are looking forward to not having to deal with health insurance, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, health insurance is a part of our compensation package, but some of those mandates that were there and, you know, the possible and budgeting issues that we were running into as a company made it very difficult for us.
If I remember right, you said it was teetering. If you had to keep going with the Affordable Care Act, you were teetering on going out of business.
Yeah, it's, you know, there was so much cost there that becomes very difficult for a small business like us where we've got 160, 165 people and those healthcare costs that continue to rise. It's very difficult to budget that and understand what the impact is going to have there. Our customers are not going to take a price increase because our insurance costs go up. They're just not interested in hearing it.
What happens if, in your mind, healthcare does not get fixed?
If healthcare doesn't get fixed and the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare continues to be instituted as all these employees, you know, they're forced to take insurance, I'm heavily concerned on those costs and what they do to us just to being able to continue to operate.
Literally going out of business? Is that what we're talking here?
Well, sure. I mean, you can't operate a business and continue to not make money. So eventually, if you can't make money, I mean, it's foolish to continue to operate a business.
Let me get you off healthcare for a second and ask you a bigger picture, how you're feeling, six-something months into the Trump presidency, about business and the regulatory environment and how things are going for you.
Well, feel pretty good when we start looking at unemployment rates that are lower than we've seen, you know, in over a decade. Starting to see some of the tariffs that possibly get imposed. I mean, for us in the plastics business, love to see tariffs that could be imposed on our neighbors to the north. You know, certainly there's no perfect administration, I don't think, but it is nice to finally see some change.
You mentioned you're going 24/7. Are you so busy that you would have to hire to fill those three shifts?
We're actually currently in a hiring mode looking for employees now.
Kerry Quigley, he's a vice president at Sterling Technologies. We talked to him on scene back in January out in Lake City, Pennsylvania, near Erie. Kerry, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
The European refugee crisis has mostly fallen out of the headlines here, but in Greece, where since 2015 more than a million refugees have landed, it is still very, very real. The European Union has provided almost $1 billion in aid, but the Greek government is still struggling to keep up. Help, though, has come from an unlikely source, self-described anarchists on the mainland and on the Greek islands who are working to house, feed, and support the new arrivals. Marketplace's Ryan Kyloth visited with some of them in Athens.
I'm checking out an abandoned public school in Athens when a little Syrian boy nearly takes my eye out with his fidget spinner.
Sorry. It's okay, but you lost a piece.
Abandoned is maybe the wrong word for this school. It closed during the worst of the country's debt crisis in 2010, and today it's home to about 400 Syrian refugees. The classrooms are now dormitories, laundries drying on the jungle gym.
We try to find buildings that they are abandoned from the state to give them life.
Tasos Sagres is a local artist who looks like an aging punk rocker. Black jeans, long hair. He's also an anarchist. He's lived for decades here in the graffiti-covered Exarchia neighborhood, home to record shops, hipster cafes, and about 3,000 refugees squatting in abandoned government buildings. Sagres says the anarchists were the first Greeks to give them housing.
Before the state, before the NGOs, before the European Union.
There are now more than 10 buildings in the neighborhood occupied by refugees. The anarchists help them reconnect the water and electricity.
So does that mean stealing it?
We just make it really public. It's not stealing, it's reappropriation.
The anarchists know how to do this stuff because they've been squatting in Exarchia for years. They moved in the 80s when the neighborhood was the center of anti-government protests. Then, during the debt crisis, they used their know-how to help Greek citizens who'd lost their homes.
The crisis had some benefits for the development of humanitarian protection systems.
Brad Blitz teaches international politics at Middlesex University. He says it's not just anarchists. Greek laborers and trade unionists have also taken lessons they learned during the crisis and applied them to helping refugees. Laid-off port workers, for example, used their connections to obtain old shipping containers and turn them into housing or storage.
And it was this collective support network that was mobilized to support refugees. There are strong cultural precedents for this in Greece.
During extended conflicts in the early 1900s, huge numbers of Greeks were forced to leave home.
So you have this strong collective memory of displacement, and it's a national phenomenon in Greece. They hold very strongly to this identity.
The Greek government, with EU funding, runs about 40 refugee camps around the country. But people there say conditions are horrible. Eva Kose is a researcher for Human Rights Watch.
You have frequent fights, fires. During the winter, people were sleeping in tents under the snow.
She's interviewed scores of refugees and says in the camps, they feel like animals in a cage.
As long as refugees are in refugee camps, they feel that they haven't settled. They don't feel safe.
Kose says conditions in the anarchist squats are much more humane. There's little violence or crime, and refugees have better access to food, sanitation, and medical services. Their kids are in local schools. They feel a part of society. Tasos Sagres says this was one of the anarchists' main motivations.
For us, it was important to meet these people, to speak with these people, to know them better, to hear their stories, to share our stories with them, like neighbors.
Sagra says their work with refugees is just a step towards their ultimate goal, revolution. They want a society without money or government, a future where nobody pays for electricity, housing, or water. In Athens, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
Coming up.
People say interns are not here to get paid. They're here to gain experience. And that's nice, but experience doesn't pay the bills?
No, it does not. First, though, let's do the numbers. As I said, Dow Industrials hit a record high today, up 123 points, 0.5%, 21,532. NASDAQ up 67 points, 1.1%, 6261. S&P 500 rose 17.7%, 2443. Walmart is raising its expectations on suppliers. As we told you earlier, stock jumped 0.6% today. Target up 0.9%. Told you about Visa pushing a cashless world up 0.8% today. PayPal rose 3.2% on this Wednesday. Energy bigwig Consol is selling its coal business to focus on natural gas instead. Shares down 1.3%. Co-producer CloudPeak gave up about 2%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.31%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Lobbying comes in many forms. Meetings and phone calls and quiet chats in the corridors of power. Also, in academic papers. A story in the Wall Street Journal today highlights how Google's Washington-based lobbying shop uses academic research to expand its influence. Brody Mullins had the story in the Journal today. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
When you say academic research, these are college professors, university professors, writing academic, usually, I assume, peer-reviewed papers that get published in journals, right?
Exactly. They're mainly law professors who are writing about intellectual property or antitrust issues or privacy issues, all the major public policy issues that Google cares about. These are issues that the government right now is sort of fighting about, and Google is essentially helping to generate lots of opinion at universities on those topics.
How does it work? Does Google put out an RFP, basically, a request for proposals, and say, listen, we want a paper on XYZ, or what's the process?
That's a really good question. It doesn't exactly work like that. It's more like Google will sort of monitor various professors and what they are writing about, and they'll find professors who happen to be taking the positions that are supported by Google. Google then reach out to those folks and say, hey, you know, we like what you're doing. We'd like you to keep doing it. We can fund your research. We can give you some more money to hire some other people or cover some expenses. And Google is careful to say they're not paying exactly for you to take the Google position, but they sort of know from the past that you're already there.
Does Google see these papers before they get published and disseminated?
In some cases, the records that we found show that they do see the papers. The professors would, sort of as a professional courtesy, send the papers to Google and say, hey, you know, let me know what your thoughts are. The professors that we spoke with said that that's a very normal practice, that it doesn't look as bad as it sounds. And what they say is that, you know, they're writing about a company or they're writing about an industry where the people in the industry themselves are the experts. They want to get the input from the companies because the companies at the end of the day are the experts. At the same time, it does just, you know, seem odd that, you know, you'd write a paper and then make sure it's okay with the company.
What about disclosure of the funding relationship?
Google says that it requires or asks its the professors receive the funding to disclose the source of the funding. What we found, though, is a lot of instances where professors didn't disclose. Some say it was a mistake. Some say they're not required to. The key sort of is that there's no standard rules. Something that I found interesting was that I think we all remember years ago there were a bunch of scandals with pharmaceutical companies and tobacco companies funding medical research, and the research report would come out and say, hey, tobacco is not bad for you.
Right.
And it turned out that was all paid for by the tobacco companies. That led to the creation of rules and standards at medical schools. This research is at law schools. Law schools don't have any rules. The tech community and these you know, intellectual property issues are new. So the law schools now are just beginning to wrestle with what their rules are.
We should point out here, and you say this in the piece, other companies, you know, Microsoft and Verizon and AT&T, they fund research that is sort of has a countervailing viewpoint to what Google wants to see happen public policy-wise.
Yeah, this is not just Google. We found Google to have the most extensive of these operations. However, there's research being funded on all sides of the issues. This is not a brand new issue. It's sort of new in the tech space because the tech space is new.
Google, when you called them and said, hey, we got this story we're doing, what'd they say?
They said that everyone does this. Google said that the funding of academic research is something that's gone on for a long time in other industries. They say that many other companies in the tech space do the same thing, and all those things are true.
Brody Mullins, he's an investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Brody, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
More than half of all the college students in this country do an internship or some kind of workplace co-op before they graduate. Experiences that come in a range of economic varieties, paid or unpaid, for college credit perhaps, or maybe with a stipend. And what said interns do runs the gamut as well, depending on where they wind up working. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Richard Van Vliet is working the soil in the garden of the Oregon Food Bank on the outskirts of Portland.
We've done a little bit of planting, so we've got everything from tomatoes to potatoes to strawberries.
The food bank isn't paying Van Vliet for his summer internship, though his school, Duke University, provides a $1,000 stipend.
I decided to do this because I wanted some work experience, and I think it's great that Duke gave me an opportunity to do this for free, basically, you know, to pay for me to be able to come out here.
According to the National Association of Colleges and Employers, 42% of interns this summer will be unpaid. To see how this system started, we have to go back in time, way back to the Middle Ages. Cue Gregorian chant. When teenagers would be apprenticed to guildmasters, say a weaver or a blacksmith. Cue historical reenactment. Syracuse University historian Andrew Cohen.
Families couldn't necessarily afford to feed all of the household, and so this was partly a way of getting rid of children who had gotten too old to not work.
The apprentice would be provided room and board.
They would sign what were called terms of indenture, in which the child owed labor to the master, and in return was taught the mysteries of the trade. Try and escape, they can have you carted back by the constable.
So it often wasn't pretty, but it did set these young people up to earn a lot more than the peasants. In the industrial era, union apprenticeship does much the same for young carpenters and machinists. Cue vocational training film.
Many apprentices in big manufacturing plants attend classes in mathematics, machine design, and science.
In the early 20th century, interns pop up in medicine. They're doctors in training, learning from experienced hands on hospital wards. Today's internships are a boon for the employers, says Peter Capelli at the Wharton School.
They want to hire people who've already got work experience. How do you get it when nobody wants to hire anybody and give them work experience? You do it for free.
Or you don't, because you can't afford to. Carlos Vera from the advocacy group Pay Our Interns says many low- and middle-income students have to earn and save for tuition in the summer. So they miss out on the networking and job opportunities that wealthier students can get from unpaid internships, which proliferate in nonprofits, government, and even for-profit fields like PR and fashion.
People say interns are not here to get paid. They're here to gain experience. And that's nice, but experience doesn't pay the bills. And that's a big inequity issue.
Vera says under federal labor laws, interns should be learning, not just filing and fetching. He says many get college credit, but that's not such a great deal.
Not only is internship not paid, they have to pay for the college credit to then intern for free.
The National Association of Colleges and Employers finds that paid interns are more likely than unpaid ones to land full-time jobs afterward, and they earn higher starting salaries, on average $10,000 higher. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Kentucky Fried Chicken becomes the brand story that just won't quit. They've done sunscreen that smells like fried chicken. We told you about that. A fried chicken-based romance novel. We told you about that, complete with reenactment. Now clothing and home decor. $14 for a Colonel Sanders pillowcase, a framed print of mashed potatoes, You get the idea. I don't get the why. All right, we got to go. The Dow, 123 points to the good today, about a half percent. NASDAQ up 67 points, 1.1%. S&P 500 up 17.7%. Brian Allison, Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Chris Morocco, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.